I don't know about you, but every morning I wake up before coffee, before talking to anybody, before thinking about anything, I pick up my phone. I engage in the internet. I engage in the digital. I've been asking myself one question all year long. How does internet, our digital landscape, influence the things we do and change the way artists and makers interface with the world?
This is Script, a multi-platform art project that consists of a podcast, publication, and exhibition.
Hi guys, welcome back to Script. I have a really special episode for you guys today. I'm going to be talking with artist M. Acuff. They have a show up right now at Carnation Contemporary in Portland, Oregon. If you're going to be in the neighborhood, if you're going to be up in Portland, you got to see the show. It's open for 2 more days. It's open from 12 to 5 both Saturday and Sunday. You should really see it. If you saw one show this year, I would recommend this show. Great work in there. It's really thoughtful and thought-provoking, and it deals with an issue that tends to feel really closed down, which is climate change. But it's really fresh in its approach. It feels very contemporary in the way that it challenges the systems in which we think about nature, and I just really cannot recommend enough for you guys to check the work out. So I'm going to start you guys in on the podcast, and we start in by talking about the work that's in the gallery right now. So I'm going to go ahead and feed you right in. Okay, let's listen.
Okay. All right, Em, describe the work you have in the show right now at Carnation Contemporary. If we walked in the gallery, what will we see? How would we experience the work? Maybe if you have a particular piece that you feel especially proud of or really interested in exploring more, maybe you could talk about that too.
Cool. Yeah. I wish that we were there at Carnation walking around. It feels odd. I feel like this is what, the third weekend, and it was intense to be with the work for a whole week and then, you know, gallery sitting for 3 days, like once it's all done, like you really just get to sit there with the work and it's so exciting. So what would we see? Well, you know, hopefully we would see a bunch of different gestures that kind of are connected thematically to explorations of how the natural world has come to be represented, and especially the natural world as it is currently sort of undergoing traumatic change, right? And so they're all just these ways for me to kind of sidle up or orient to that reality. And I have a lot of sort of suspicion and fear and hesitation about being able to even speak about something so large as climate change. And so, you know, I try to use all these different tools like hyperbole and, you know, hyper aestheticization. And I try to mix up materials, right? Like video, so that there's moving imagery and there's light, right? Like as just as a material alongside other things like cement and wood and steel. And I just try to create a really complex situation in which all these things are kind of bouncing off of each other. In the show, you'll see photographs, and some are photographs of other photographs, and you'll see imagery, and most of it is all very low tech, like, you know, all the videos I made on my iPhone and, you know, filtered with like just the very easily accessible filters that you'd find in like iMovie, like very low-tech approach to technology. And I'm interested in that because it keeps it sort of close to the body, right? Everything is made with this thing that's in my hand in a lot of ways. And so then it's like it's linked just by proximity to my hand and my eyes and what I'm seeing in the world. And, you know, I have a real long history with working with certain materials and wanting to make statements about primarily about like the fragility of the world. So everything sort of looks like it maybe is kind of going to collapse, or there's a strong emphasis formally on kind of like infrastructures, like, well, there's images and then there's these things that kind of hold up the images or at least are in relationship to the images.
Yeah, you can definitely see that in that piece Genesis. Just the fact that the
construction underneath that's holding up those beautiful, is that aluminum or steel?
Aluminum pieces, steel.
Yeah. Those steel pieces feels very fragile, but you can tell that there's a sort of stability in the structure itself. And also, you know, I was thinking about your work because I actually gallery sat yesterday. There is a sort of hyper aestheticization of the things that are in there. Like, even though it's using like low tech methods, you've got that beautiful piece that says nature, that's the neon sign, and everything's kind of glossy. And I started thinking about how we kind of aestheticize nature these days in order to get people outside and get people engaged and get people thinking about nature in a way that we're almost commodifying it in order to kind of bring on a new resurgence of people enjoying the outdoors. But there's a lot of really authentic ways that we then engage. But there's this like package that's kind of sold to us in order to reinvest in those moments. And I felt like your work was sending these really kind of heavier messages through, though, this sort of package of aestheticizing it or glossing it up or making it really visually poppy. I didn't mean to go on a tangent there, but I was thinking a lot about that when I was looking at especially that piece, Genesis.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is about that desire I have to be intimate with the natural world, but like it's mediated through all these, you know, ideas and actually technologies and, you know, everything about our interaction, right? We live in buildings that are climate controlled and, you know, our food comes to us in packages. We don't like pull it from the earth or have to shoot it or kill it or whatever. So like the distance is so enormous between us and the natural world, but yet we fetishize it and glorify it and know that we're dependent on it and part of it. And so, yeah, I think some of my strategy is about like using these really saccharine colors. You know, there's a lot of pastels in that show, but it's also like things can get really saturated quickly in my work. And it's, you know, it's about a lot of things. And sometimes it's about like just that, the pleasure of those sensations, you know, the blue sky, the river that's running clear, the whatever. But it's also, you know, mediated by the fact that everything is commodified and hypercolored and technicolor. And that's kind of just the world that we live in, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, it's about kind of that push pull and my sort of frustration with you know, longing for the natural world and wanting to send it love letters, you know, through my work, but also being really suspicious about how close I could ever get, you know, intellectually to experiencing it because the machinery and the apparatus that sort of now it's constructed through.
Yeah, totally. Hey guys, in this next clip, I talked to Em about a piece that they're still thinking about, something that's in the show that's been outputted, but they still can't get out of their mind. And we start talking about a piece called Blurry Polar Bear, which is a series of digital images that exist on the wall, thinking about the fragility of the medium itself. They're put up in a way that avoids its preciousness. We're going to talk a lot about that piece, how M generated the images, how their residency to the Arctic Circle influenced the work that they did. So let's hear about that. Because I know that when we create work, we're never really at a standstill when a piece gets delivered out. You know, we're constantly kind of still ruminating about things. So is there a piece that's still sticking with you that you made in the show that you feel like you're going to explore further or a process that you felt really connected to?
Yeah, I guess I was pretty happy with how the Blurry Polar Bear piece is, you know, living inside that particular show. This is the first time I've printed these photos out. And for me, they're kind of big. They're like 30 by 30 and they're not protected at all. So they're really vulnerable, you know, like as paper is. Relative to like some of the other materials that I work with where like, you know, if I drop the steel, it's fine or the wood, whatever. But, you know, I didn't want those photographs to get damaged. And in some way that became of a piece with the content of the images, you know, which is about, again, kind of my inability to trust what we see and what we know through seeing. I have probably 100 photographs of blurry polar bears that I took in the Arctic Circle, and they're all from books. You know, I just used my iPhone and I made the phone go close enough that it couldn't focus so that it made it blurry. And, you know, they're all photos that someone else took, but I've, you know, cropped them in different ways and I've colorized a little bit of them. But it was all in response to, you know, there was this, I was there with a guy who had this giant lens, you know, this $10,000 lens. And we were always looking for the polar bears because that is our instinct, right? They're just absolutely charismatic and, you know, they're diminished and suffering. And so we just wanted to bear witness to them. But he was the only one that was able to really get good images. There was one polar bear that came close, but most of the polar bears that we saw were really tiny and really far away. But he was so proud of these images that he could make with his giant lens. And I was just like, well, what's in those images? Yeah. What are they really showing? You know, what kind of vision is that? And how is that linked to other ways that we see or understand nature or these giant animals? And so I just thought, I'm going to make an archive of images that I think show how hard it is to see.
Yeah.
So they're really beautiful images, you know, because they are kind of still saturated. They're blurry. Like they still are affecting. And so, yeah, I'm pretty excited about thinking about, well, what do I do if I have 100 of these images? What are the possible ways to configure it? You know, I have only 5 to show there. And I liked it that I, you know, partly because of how bright that space was, I had to use these little I kind of fabricated those lights. They're from like 2 different lights that I put together just as, and it becomes like a memorial, you know, it's like sort of dimly lit. So I'm excited about exploring that more. Yeah. And seeing where that can.
Yeah. Those images in the front, I love how they're kind of really not displayed in a way that you would imagine digital photography to the way that we make it very precious and we frame it and we kind of like try to stabilize. We try to make it more stable by creating a frame around it, because actually digital media, paper photographs are really fragile, which I think is relative to kind of what you're talking about as far as content about how we can grasp nature, but also relative to digital media as a whole. Like it's these things that move past us in very fast ways and then they get kind of disregarded and then the new thing kind of comes out and a new photograph kind of gets made, and there's a real temporality about that process. So I think that in a lot of ways, the way that you displayed it was really resonated with the process itself, like the medium itself, like the fragility of the paper and the content within. So I think it was singing on all these different levels that just made me sit in front of it for a long time. Yeah. So did you go to a place to actually see polar bears? I didn't know you went on a physical.
Yeah, I went on the Arctic Circle residency a couple summers ago now.
Wow.
So we were 30 people and 28 artists and 2 scientists. And we were all just there for like 2.5 weeks sailing around the Arctic, looking at everything, like trying to basically look climate change in the face. But what that means, you know, it's like it's a residency, but it's not like you have a place to make your work. You're making your work there on the land or through your photograph, you know, your image gathering devices or sound gathering. There were different people doing different things. And it was about kind of trying to generate a conversation. But yeah, so that was just one of the pieces that sort of came out of that. And this is the first time I've shown it. I've talked about the Glory Polar Bear idea, right? But I haven't had an opportunity to show it until now.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your a day in your studio. How do you start it? What does it look like?
Well, kind of similar to Catherine's response, having listened to her podcast, the day in the studio, that sounds like a fantasy. Like, who gets to have a whole day in the studio? And that's not true, because I definitely go on sabbatical and I have summers, but I think what I've tried to do in my life is create a studio mindset that allows me to be thinking about the work. And yes, I have a studio in my home here and I have a studio at school and I'm able to kind of be in those spaces. But most of the time I'm having to carry it with me mentally, you know, like in a book, or until I can get to that space, or even when I'm not in that space, you know, if I'm just reading or thinking, or I can be doing that in all different kinds of places. It is luxurious though, when I get to really just spend time executing, although then of course, like the labor takes over, you know? And I mean, I have this fantasy of having one big space where all of it happens, you know, like the big studio where you have the couch and then like the kitchen and all the ways that you get messy and all that. But that's not a reality. And I don't know if that would actually change the work, you know, like if it were all happening in one space as opposed to like, oh, I have a tiny space here and a tiny space there and this space can't get dirty and that space can and so on and so forth. So it's been a little while since I've had like just like consecutive days of being in the studio. And for sure, those are precious rhythms that develop. And it takes days, I think, to get that going, right? You need to get momentum. So we're all like just trying to make it happen, like minute to minute.
Totally. If I knew it, I guess what I try to instill in my students a lot is like, wow, really appreciate this time. They all talk about how busy they are. And which I understand, a lot of people are working and going to school. But if I knew what I knew now in graduate school, I think I would have been like, wow, this is incredible. Because you do have to kind of compartmentalize and like sit there and say, and you in the affordable space that you can kind of work in, you know, you're kind of having to separate yourself between all these different spaces in order to facilitate a practice. Yeah, totally. Totally. Okay. The next question I'll ask is, and we kind of covered this a little bit in the work that's in the show, but maybe you could go into a little bit further because we are a podcast. We're listening to it audibly to talk about your work visually to us. Like what kind of elements would we see? What are some really go-to materials that end up in your practice quite often?
Yeah. Well, I think something that's been in the work for a long time is a juxtaposition between images and objects. I've been working, doing that, situating video and materials in relationship to each other for a long time. I mean, since at least graduate school, when I was looking to people like Ann Hamilton and Toni Wurzler and people who are really interested in like, you know, the preciousness of the video and slowing things down and not having it be this like fast paced, you know, hyper cut montage type thing, but just like these little like illuminated moments often is how they sort of used to show up. And now, you know, I'm interested in the sort of the big image, but I'm interested in the big slow image as well, or more so than any fast imagery. And color is super important to me, and that maybe comes from like, you know, really starting out as a painter. But then kind of go-to materials to me are wood and metal, even though they seem a little bit old-fashioned or they're just easy. I know how to make them do things that...
Well, and you're totally not using them in a way that's old-fashioned. I feel like you've got some positioning. At least in the work that I've seen, it feels like you're kind of wedging yourself against something that's treated traditionally and making it more contemporary in the way that you're displaying it. So I don't think, you know, when I think of wood and metal, I'm not seeing you work in very traditional methods. Sorry.
Partly it's like part of that is that it does point in these different directions. Like the materials themselves, they are utilitarian, you know, like you can build a house with 2x4s. Yeah. You can cut them up and make a sculpture. So I like that they are part of the vernacular of just like everyone's everyday experience. I've often used the polystyrene, you know, that extruded polystyrene. So the strap-on iceberg is made out of that, layered together. And often I want that to be visible, and it's really only visible in the color. I mean, I chose the material and the color, because I guess you can get it in pink and purple, but I chose the blue because it's related to this blue that we see in the Arctic. And why is that? And you know, who makes these choices to color material in ways that, in this case, I think are trying to speak to its innocuousness when that is, the opposite is true, right? These are very toxic materials that have huge lifespans and impacts on them in their manufacture, and they have like very insidious histories chemically. So I'm really interested in those things. So yeah, styrofoam has actually been a big material for me. And I think it started out as being like, oh, this is a light material. I can ship it around and I can make anything I want with it. But then I started to investigate it more. And it's just kind of keeps coming back up. Like, this is the material to use.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah. You just, sometimes you get to a place where you're working with a process or a material and you're like, okay, this is functional in these ways, but you're not sure why you gravitate to it. And the more you use it, you're like, wait a second, there's this whole other thing that's happening that I wasn't, you know, aware of, even within my own, you know, thought process and practice.
Hey guys, this is Script special episode with M. Acuff. Their work is showing right now at Carnation Contemporary, and we're right in the midst of talking about how a project is started. For all artists, it's very different. You know, some artists start with a book. Some artists get inspired by other artists. Some artists are inspired by a process or an output. And so we're going to listen to how M starts their process. So push you guys right into that conversation.
Let's talk about how you start or generate an idea. Like, where does the start process form in your mind? Is it something you see or read, or is it just a splash of an idea? How do you start a project usually?
Well, typically, I feel like I'm always midstream. So, you know, I'm always have the work that I've made is either around me literally or not so far from my mind's eye, and I'm actually often recycling and reincorporating some materials like that nature sign I've used for years now. You know, mm-hmm. It just sort of shows up in different juxtapositions. So I feel like I'm always kind of like midstream trying to gather what I feel is the most significant information about what I should make. And then there are these sort of like experiences that will punctuate my practice, like going to the Arctic, you know, so yeah. Like going to the Arctic, and then it's like, okay, now I'm going to make work in response to that. And it's related to work that I've made previously because subject wise, thematically, there's a thread, but there's also this new information that I've taken in. So that's, and then I just start to draw in my book typically. And I'll come up with ideas, and I often really am just require stillness in that early ideation phase, you know, where I'm just like sitting still, like just trying to imagine the thing. I have to imagine it before I can bring it into being. And then I sort of draw it, and then I figure out how to make it. But I certainly do that to many more things than I'm actually able to make, right? Because there's only so many hours in the day. So that's why we're like a book, you know, like a sketchbook becomes useful in that I can say, okay, well, yeah, I drew that iceberg and I drew that mountain and I drew that river, and like, you know, which one am I going to choose to make now? Cause I have like 2 weeks and I can try and make something in that time. And so somehow there's just a natural process of sifting, and the thing that I keep coming back to, like, you know, there's things that I'll draw that I won't come back to, like, okay, that was an idea. And so I feel like time allows me to just, you know, cause there isn't time to make everything. So
yeah.
Make the things that you feel the strongest about. So I don't typically make something, or I don't make things in my studio where I'm like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm just putting stuff. I admire though. And when I see students do that, you know, when they're just sort of like sketching in materials, I get really jealous. I'm like, I never do. And like, I'll try to give myself the assignment, like just sketch with some materials, Acuff. Like, what do you have to lose? But then it's like, oh, but I have this show, or I have this thing, or there's all these different pressures to
make
that sort of fits with your trajectory. And so
I totally get that. So wait, question though, the things that you sketch, do they end up being, do they change a lot over the process of making it? Because there's a big transformation between paper and pen and the thing itself.
For sure. I mean, I'm pretty good at now at being able to have them correspond. But yeah, obviously a lot happens when you're working with the material. Like, well, so for instance, that in the Genesis piece, there's that steel, like pool waterfall thing that kind of happens at the end of it. And I've been drawing that for a long time and then trying to make it in these different materials. And it just wasn't working out. And I thought it was going to have to happen in a, like a really organic material. Like I got a bunch of felt and I got other different kind of cloths, and then and finally it was just like, it's, I thought it had to be organic, or I was trying to get that quality of a pencil line into a material, and it was just not happening, you know. I worked with wire, and then finally I was just like, I have to use this thicker steel and I have to weld it, and I still don't love it, and I kind of want to play with it, but it sufficed for what I was kind of trying to do there. But yeah, that's something that I'm going to revisit. You know, I'm going to bring that back to my show and I'm going to be like, how do I make this like really what I want it to be?
Yeah, totally. Totally.
So life is art, right? And art is life. That's what they say. That's the saying. But maybe it's true. Maybe research is all around us. Maybe everything we look at gets filtered in some way and it outputs in the things that we make. So we're going to talk a little bit about research for M, and we're going to talk about how research is very much tied to just the experience of being. So let's hear about that.
Okay, so another question is, how much time do you spend versus research versus production? The actual output versus all the pre-research?
Yeah, I mean, it's curious. I don't know where you draw the line between research and just like living, you know, like I'm gonna go see the new Jordan Peele movie tonight. And like, I feel like that's research, you know, like, yeah.
I feel like Seinfeld sometimes research, you know?
Yeah. Nothing is not research, which is what's kind of beautiful about being an artist, you know, like just being alive is a form of research. You know, you're researching what it means to be alive right now. And so, yeah, to me, going to Home Depot, it's, you know, naturally that I would gravitate to these materials because I'm already going there to do other projects because I like to build things that are totally utilitarian as well.
Yeah.
As sculptural.
Man, they should have a Home Depot artist discount, let me tell you.
Right.
So much money spent. Yeah. And you can never visit Home Depot under the premise of like, I'm doing this project and I'm not going to look at these other things and think about possibilities here. You know, you're like, oh, I just need this set of nails. And then all of a sudden I'm in like the metal aisle, you know, looking at, what was I looking at the other day? Everything to do with plumbing. I was looking at a lot of plumbing fixtures and I was like, why am I here? Got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But, you know, I, as a teacher, I'm sure you experience this, like I have to read a ton and I like to read a ton and I'm always framing things that I read for students or trying to package it, you know, as relevant to them. So, and relevant to me. So I don't know, I would say there's more research for sure. I would say 70%. I know you didn't ask for a number, but, and I think I would like to play with that more, you know, that ratio. Like that's one of the things I try to do in the summer when I'm not teaching is like interrogate my habits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, all right, well, what if you don't rely upon a book, you know, to give you an idea about a thing you want to make? Like you just figure it out some other way.
Yeah. So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Hey guys, again, you're listening to Script, a special episode with M. Acuff. In this section, we talk about professional practice, and I think it's really important because everything else within an artistic practice is kind of bared on the shoulders of the artist. You have to figure out not only what to make, you have to figure out what the ideas are around that thing that you make, you have to figure out how to make it, figure out what skills to learn or what processes to engage in. And there's this one place, this professional practice place, where we would all be better off sharing information that we have with each other in order for everyone to kind of get a sense of how each artist operates within that realm. I've just asked M about what are some things that they have learned over the time that they've spent as a professional working artist. So let's hear about that.
Can you share some things you've learned over time as a working artist? I'm thinking that this podcast not only helps artists that are working in our same sort of capacity where we're at in our careers, but also artists that are maybe starting out or graduating and or going for their MFA. And I'm thinking that maybe you have some great advice to give.
I wish I did. You know, I feel a generational, you know, abyss is opening up a little bit with, you know, what my mental habits are now, what they were when I was in college and graduate school and where my students are now. And, you know, as a teacher, you're always sort of like, you were the geekiest student. You were the one that wanted to learn everything. And so, you know, I'm good at like pitching to that crowd, but I have to pitch to everyone, you know? And so I'm just trying to figure out how to get them to be excited about their own process of inquiry. Like, how do you figure out what you're really interested in? How do you develop curiosity, which is not something anyone ever had to teach me, you know?
Like,
kind of naturally wanting to explore materials. And now I feel like, oh, this is a skill I need to build in my students. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that is. I mean, I have some ideas about how the culture has changed, but, you know, to me, work is sort of the key, you know, like you don't just go to the studio when you feel inspired. You go to the studio because what you're going to do, you're going to put your body in that place to allow those things to, those wheels to turn. And it's not always going to be pleasure. It's often going to be peace.
I'm glad you said that. Sometimes I feel like maybe my ratio of pleasure to studio practices being painful, you know, people are like, you should love it. You should enjoy it. And I'm like, yeah, but there's a lot of things that need to kind of move and be, they're working parts of my studio practice that maybe take a lot of effort, a lot of output, you know? So I feel that sometimes. And then I sometimes feel bad about that. I'm like, shouldn't I be a maker that enjoys this process more, you know, than I do? But, you know, I think sometimes it is about really putting the work in, and I find value in that. So,
yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a grit or a strength that comes from that kind of discipline. But I'm not sure if I see that in my students, having that ability to just be bored or frustrated or push through. And, you know, they're also young, so maybe they will acquire that. You know, that's certainly my hope. I mean, and there are absolutely exceptions to the rule, but they are definitely exceptions, you know, people who just really want to have that fire and are just want to learn and find their way through these, you know, acquiring these new languages and these new skills. And, you know, I guess being able to teach yourself is like such a powerful thing, you know?
And it's so available now. You know what I mean? Like, it's so right there. You could just touch a button and you could teach yourself anything. Right now, I took there's a class online for $100. It's about developing your own glazes. It's by this guy, Matt Katz, who teaches at Alfred. It was $100. Okay, fair. It's not a YouTube video. It's not free. But wow, I'm just like, it's blowing my mind that I could take 14 classes on my own time while I'm in the studio working, while I'm just listening to it like a podcast, and I'm just sucking in all this information. And a lot of my time teaching is trying to tell students like, wow, you have so many resources that are just right there in front of you. Like, you could learn how to do this tomorrow if you wanted, or take some weird technical thing somebody's trying to tell you about this program and turn it on its head and utilize it in your practice in some way. And the accessibility is there. So I do wonder why that is, because I definitely feel the same way about students. I'm really trying to get them to just generate interest in that sort of process of discovery. You know, I don't know. I don't know why. Yeah.
Prior to my show at Carnation, you know, there were 2 months where I was just like, look, I am in studio mode, and like I mentally, you know, even if I wasn't physically in the studio, mentally that's where I'm at, and I'm yet I have to go through the motions of teaching these classes and show up for these students. But I had this one class of smaller and more advanced students, and I was like, look, I'm gonna be honest with you, this is my situation, and so I need you guys to really, you know, dig deep and find a way to, you know, move through a process a little bit more on your own. You know, I'm not gonna give you assignments and tell you what I think at every moment. And it's going to be hard, but there is this is a real opportunity for you to figure out, like, well, what are the limits of your, you know, self and the academic institution and what you're curious about, you know, because like there's no, I'm not putting any boundaries on this, but that's its own problem. And you're going to have to see how you do in that context. And, you know, we're coming back now after break, and they're going to, you know, they're going to put their own exhibition up, and we'll talk about, you know, what that was like. But I can already say it was kind of painful to watch. You know?
You're like, oh no, like, just let them go up. Whoosh. Yeah, I know. I speak into the choir. So I was going to ask about open calls or opportunities. But I guess what I'm really interested in knowing is, there's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of things that you could potentially do as an artist. Like, how do you gravitate towards the next opportunity that you really are interested in? Or how do you sift through those things?
I mean, one of the benefits of being in my position where, you know, I have tenure and unlikely to lose my job, you know, that capitalism is still likely to crash and burn. But, you know, I have not a lot of pressure driving my practice, right? Like, no one is saying, like, you have to have this many shows. And so because of that, I look at calls and I'll definitely apply to ones that I think are a good fit. But I'm also now more forced to rely upon my internal, like, what impetus, like, what is driving your practice, ACUF? Mm-hmm. Like, what really do you want to do? Like, what feels really meaningful and really important? And so that's, those are the kinds of questions I'm asking myself. And if you'd known me for 5 years, you would know that I've been saying for a while now, I need to do performance, or at least like something more theatrical, where I involve my body in the work. You know, and I've asked my students to do this, and I've done it some. You know, I come to TBA every year at PICA, and I do the workshops, you know, with the dancers and the this and that. And I try to, like, get my body to become this intelligent instrument in a way that it's not yet. And, or whatever. Like, I just feel like that's important to me in terms of sculpture. And so I've been slowly putting together those pieces, and I feel like my next big thing, like, is to, you know, and some of it has happened with colleagues here, like in the theater department where I teach. I've had great collaborations and so on. And I want to do something that is more theatrical in nature, and I want it to involve my body along with the things that I make, the objects. But I want to generate gestures and things. But I think it's more about taking bigger risks for me. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if the world needs more, you know, strap on icebergs, another, you know,
maybe they do. Maybe they need a lot more,
but I just want to be in the work in a new way. And so that's where I'm kind of responding, what I'm responding to now, opportunities for that. So I did a residency at Jurassic a couple years ago now. And, that was super cool just because of who's there, you know, and how isolated it is. It's in Northern California. And there were dancers and, you know, people who were just really savvy on all these different kinds of levels and playwrights. And so that kind of thing, yeah. I need to figure out how to have in my daily life. And maybe, you know, my next sabbatical will be in Portland or something where I can have people close by. I mean, there are a few people here in Walla Walla where I live, but I don't know. I have to remove all obstacles to that and try to figure out how to make it happen.
Yeah, totally. I totally relate to the sentiment of stretching yourself or your practice. I think once you hit a point, you just really want to keep stretching yourself and keep stretching the possibilities, for sure.
So I've been thinking a lot about success this year. What does success mean? This is especially hard for artists because the things that we measure as a level of success are short indicators. It might be a solo show, or maybe a grant that you receive, or some additional funding. And those kind of things can make you feel successful in the moment, but it just gets kind of pushed down the line, and then we have to think about other things that feel successful to us. So maybe a better way to think about it is what I'm doing, does that feel authentic to me? Or is my practice reaching people I want it to reach? Or am I sending the messages that I feel proud of or feel like I can stand behind? And so in this next section, we'll talk about what is success to M. And we'll also talk about some readings that have really influenced their practice. So let's go ahead and listen to these next few clips. It's really interesting stuff.
How do you see success in a project? Like, what do you see as a success? Or how do you understand it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've always been interested in the 30-year career, the 40-year career, like decades of consistently asking, you know, a certain kind or a level of question. So my success comes from, you know, stepping back from this little show at Carnation and being like, you know, am I doing the things that I'm trying to do, that I'm to tell myself I'm trying to do? Like, is it physically achieving that? And, you know, did I excite myself in the process? Did I discover something new? Did it make me want to make more of these things, or, like, you know, find an even bigger space, or all that kind of thing? And it did, you know, it really set me on fire just to create all these little juxtapositions. But, you know, again, it comes back to risk too. Like, am I really risking? Like, I'm in a very privileged position, white, you know, middle class.
Yeah.
All these things, like, I have job security and all of that. Like, I have years of education that have helped me be able to say things. And am I saying something that is important?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I know I don't have, like, the answers to these questions, but, you know, I get a little bit of feedback every now and then, and I felt good. And there's still more to be done. So.
Yeah, totally. I also wanted to ask, what books or writing influence your work? If you could give us a couple good reads.
Yeah. Well, I've been really geeking out on reading about biology lately. I'm just going to grab a book.
I like that you have a very accessible library behind you. No one will see this, but people should understand that there's about 1,000 books behind you.
Yeah, I feel lucky about that. I don't know. Like, I am reading always about art in the Anthropocene, but this book, The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert, who writes mostly for The New Yorker, is just about how biologists think. And I'm really fascinated by that. Like, I can tell you this one little short story. So, like, they're interested in looking at how animals adapt to the different changes in their temperature. So humans are the only species that can kind of go anywhere, and we can just put on a puffy coat or build a shelter or whatever. But most things, like trees or other animals that can actually walk, like, can only tolerate certain temperature differentials. And so biologists are trying to understand, you know, what are the bandwidths for each species? And how do, you know, can they adapt? Well, there's this one stork that has evolved this adaptation to being hot. And it is basically shitting on its legs. It
defecates
on its legs to cool itself down. And I don't think they're alone in doing this. But, you know, here I am reading these things, and I'm kind of like, how did the biologists conclude this? Like, what kind of thinking do the biologists have to engage in? And, like, the biologist is basically, like, watching the storks for a long time and then, like, just taking notes. Like, that level of observation and awareness to me is, like, mystical. And it's similar to, like, the artist.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
Like, how we, like, the kind of consciousness that we try to cultivate, you know, because you have to see that and witness that and then, like, theorize about that behavior. Well, you say, well, now this is what they do.
Well, it's obviously not this. It's not generating this result. So here we are at this. Yeah, totally.
But I'm kind of really fascinated by how scientists do that, or just the forms of thinking that will allow us to see the world differently. Like, you know, so that doesn't mean I want to go become a biologist, but it means I want to kind of harness that, you know, even if it's just stylistically, and even turn that into some sort of performance, or, you know, not with a story. With the
show. Like, maybe I won't go that level.
Yeah.
Hey guys, for our final clips today, we're going to hear about what M listens to in the studio, and we're going to talk about what's coming up on the horizon. So let's give that a listen.
Okay, listen to in the studio. Can you give us some music? Or podcasts?
I'm going to embarrass myself.
No, please do. Please do.
I mean, I really love silence, actually. And other than that, I have a few people that I listen to kind of more regularly. But if I really just want to shift my mental frame, my go-to is Taylor Swift.
It's totally fine. Great.
Yeah, I just really am made happy by her.
For my last question, to sum this up, on the horizon, where are you headed now? What do you got going on, Em? What are you thinking?
I guess I'm building this piece that will involve all the things that I already do, but I'm going to add my body to it. And I'm not sure how to do it other than, I have a physical space in mind, and I feel like as I have a venue in mind, like it's going to be kind of a performative lecture in some way. Like, well, I'm going to bill it that way, at first, so that I can call up my friends who teach at different places. And I'll be like, I'll come and do a lecture for your class, and it, because I think a lot about sculptural history, I have a lot of thoughts that connect things to that. And so, like that piece that was in the first date show, the Brancusi's Endless Column made out of the coolers, was my attempt to talk about climate change in relationship to race, to kind of connect these engines of genocide and ecocide, yet like it's a hard thing to hold together, but I want to probably unpack that for people in a kind of performative lecture way.
I think that's an interesting way to kind of touch on not only performance, but sort of how lecture becomes this sort of power dynamic, even from the person giving the lecture to the kind of content that's being delivered, for sure.
Yeah, and I'm interested in the content around gender that comes with those performances, right? Mm-hmm. And the history of performance in relation to, how it's allowed people to think newly about gender. So that's definitely part of it. And it has kind of come out in the sculptural work, but, just because I kind of couldn't keep it in, I had to put that dildo on that, that sculpture, so I just want to see where else that can go.
Yeah.
So that's on the future horizon. Maybe at Carnation, we'll see.
Amazing talking to you, Em. I just first want to say, podcast aside, you're a really valuable maker, and I really admire your work and the way that you think. And I mean, I just walked into that show and I was blown away. So thank you for doing this.
Thank you. It's super fun to get to know you all and to, I feel like there's a way to be a part of a community there. And I just hope I can show up more. I'm so excited for all the rest of the shows. There's like some big hitters coming soon. So
looks
great. Great things ahead.
All right, Em.
Thank you for asking me to do this. I appreciate it.
Hey guys, it's really been a pleasure. Amazing episode with Emma Cuff. Some amazing things that I know I'll take away. Please check out the work if you've got an opportunity. It's at Carnation Contemporary in Portland, Oregon. It's only open for 2 more days. I can't impress upon you enough how great this show is. If you're interested in seeing more of the artist's work, you can go to www.carnationcontemporary.com. Or you can go to the artist's website at macuff.com. That's emmacuff.com. A couple other notes. If you want more information or want to subscribe to our podcast, we're on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. And you can check out our podcast directly at our website at www.digitalexhibition.space. Remember, we've got some artist workshops coming up, and they're all free and open to the public, and I will be releasing those dates super soon, so be on the lookout for that. And make sure to sign up for our mailing list so you'll be first and foremost to know. And I have one last announcement. This is kind of a shout out to my partner, who's such a support to me. His name's Russell Bourne, and he has a show coming up at Carnation Contemporary on April 6th. He's got an opening. It's called Highest Form of Flattery. They're reincarnations of historic works of art that give both homage and perversion to the original works. And I can hear him right now sawing away on the table saw. And so he's working really hard to get that show together. And I think it's going to be a great show as well. So make sure to check that out. It'll be at Carnation Contemporary from 6 to 9 on April 6th. Look forward to some more podcasts coming up on the horizon from me. This is Brittany Conley, and you've been listening to Script. See ya.